Wendell Thompson's famed choral piece, Alleluia, played there in transcription by the Ying String Quartet. David Ying, the cellist of the quartet, is with me. And good morning, David.
Morning, Vern. Great to be here.
And right away, go back to when you learned this, when you transcribed it, when you recorded it. What was that process? Did you engage heavily in the choral aspect of it?
Well, funnily enough, we were not intending to play it at all in the first place, and it was as practical a situation as we had this remaining little slot to fill out the time on a CD, and we couldn't find the appropriate American piece of music. We were playing American music from the first half of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Couldn't find the right thing, and all of a sudden, someone had a little light bulb moment. What if we transcribed that? So it was. I mean, it's a beautiful piece of music, first of all. But we had lots of thoughts about, you know, like, what does it mean to play it in a string quartet versus sing it? But we did think about certain things like enunciating words. We don't always think about that when we're playing string quartets, even though there is only one word to say in that piece. But still, we thought about, how do you say Alleluia on a string instrument? Mm-hmm. We changed the registers a little bit because the violins can go higher than a soprano can go. Sure. And the cello can go a little lower sometimes than men. So we adapted a little bit towards the strings too. But we did think more specifically, I think especially with the text and sort of vocal color about that when we were putting that together. It was fascinating. We should do it more often.
Yeah, it's great for an ensemble, isn't it?
It is, because I think constantly when you play an instrument, you want to think of how you can sound like other things besides your instrument. Mm-hmm. You know, like we as string players, oftentimes we talk about what are the color of a wind players or the articulation of a piano, and ultimately, how do we sound like singers? And that includes texts and so many other things.
Yeah. Well, really lovely. I mean, all of us who have sung that or directed it all our lives, you understood all the moments of it. It was really lovely. The Ying Quartet has such a fascinating beginning and history, certainly in its involvement with Eastman School of Music, but also involvement with a small town in Iowa. First, just kind of what were the practical things? Were you all students at Eastman playing as a quartet, then got sent to Iowa, or how did that work? How did that happen?
So as we were graduating from Eastman, which you'll remember too, as a fellow alumni of Eastman.
Sure.
Sometimes it's a very scary moment. You're finishing training at this amazing institution, a sort of almost cocoon-like, where you've been taken care of, and everyone around you loves Beethoven just as much as you, if not even more. Then to think about what you're going to do after that is kind of daunting in a way. We knew that we had enjoyed amazing training there. We studied with the Cleveland Quartet, who was the resident quartet when we were students. And so I think we all had a certain amount of confidence that we knew what we wanted to do as a string quartet, musically speaking, but professionally, not so much. So as we finished our degrees there, we thought, well, we could go to New York City.
Be one of 1,000 quartets in New York City.
Exactly, and see what happens. See if we could attract the attention of the music world somehow. And then at that very same year as we were graduating, coincidentally, the National Endowment for the Arts was beginning a program that they called the Rural Chamber Music Rural Residencies Initiative. It's a mouthful. But what they aimed to do, which was, I thought, a wonderful idea, especially in retrospect, they wanted to help serious young chamber music ensembles like ourselves that didn't know exactly where to plant themselves, and also serve underserved rural areas. So we applied for that program. Again, still not knowing exactly whether we'd do that or go to New York City. They're pretty two opposite ideas in certain ways. And we were enlisted in the program and then selected by a couple of towns. And the town that chose us that we wound up going to was Jessup, Iowa, which is a farm town of about 2,000 people in northeast Iowa. And the National Endowment, as well as the town itself, supported our residency there for what amounted to 2 years in the end. It was a one-year commitment at first. And I have to say, in short, it was life-changing for our quartet. It it honed our sense of why we're musicians, mm-hmm. In a nutshell.
Now, when they selected you, they looked around. Who are they going to find? Did they feel that you had within yourselves, beyond great playing, that sense of wonder, of depth, of communication that you were able to find?
It was a pilot program. I don't think they knew what they were going to find, and I don't think we knew what we were going to find either. And in fact, it was the then director of Eastman, Robert Freeman, who encouraged us to give it a try. He said, I think you'll learn a lot from doing that. Mm-hmm. He was, of course, very right. Mm-hmm. And judging by the other groups that did the program, because there were nine in all that mm-hmm. were in this, some took to it like we did and threw ourselves into it. And there were others that it was a tougher sell. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, and we couldn't have known either. Mm-hmm. Nothing about our training at Eastman could have prepared us for what it felt like to be the resident quartet of a farm town.
I know, yeah. No, we don't need horror stories, but there must have been a unique oh dear or something every now and then as you get going,
One of the reasons why we went to Iowa in the first place is we had grown up in Chicago. Yeah. And my quartet is, incidentally, at the time was a group of all siblings too. So that was an additional kind of unusual thing about our quartet, not just living in a farm town. But we thought, you know, being from the Midwest, that maybe, okay, we would sort of have some commonality. In reality, day-to-day life in a farm town is pretty different from day-to-day life in Chicago. But what we did realize also being there is that people are people. Mm-hmm. And when we focused on the humanity of people and why we need things like music in our lives— for that matter, sports, I think, can form a powerful community-building mm-hmm. function in towns and communities. That became a much larger thing than us being comfortable with, you know, like, these people make their living plowing fields, and we're mm-hmm. making our living playing string quartets, mm-hmm. you know.
One thing about Iowa, they are deeply respectful of education, aren't they?
It was easy to talk to them about any kind of human pursuit. I don't know if that comes from their educational system or just from their respect of humanity. Mm-hmm. I was deeply touched by that. They were very generous and welcoming. I mean, they had no idea what to make of mm-hmm. us either, I think, at the beginning. I was told in the end when we became very close friends with them, obviously,
of course.
And I still keep in touch with mm-hmm. many of them. We exchange cards at holidays mm-hmm. and stuff. But I was told by one of them that the moment when they really knew that we belonged in their community was when they saw us at a high school football game.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's true. It's these human connections that in the end draw us together. Mm-hmm. And then music expresses that so beautifully, especially mm-hmm. classical music, I think.
And, of course, your job as you had so many jobs interfacing and teaching and presenting. But what did you learn about how to present music to people who maybe don't know it? What to say, what not to say to really entice them into this wonderful thing?
Well, the funny thing is, I think we went there with tons of knowledge about the pieces, quite a lot of technical skill, thanks to our education at Eastman. Mm-hmm. And we went there thinking, well, we have a lot of time to rehearse and even hone our skills even that much more. But I think when we started playing for them that they weren't all that concerned with if we were 100% in tune or 99.5% in tune.
Right.
Or if that downbeat was exactly together, yeah. or if the articulation was exactly what Beethoven conceived of in that moment. Actually, we don't even know what Beethoven conceived of anyhow. But I think what they were interested in is, like, why should we care about this music? Mm-hmm. And some of it is, you know, generations old. Mm-hmm. We played them new things too. Mm-hmm. But why should we care about this music? And for us to grapple with that question became much larger point of discussion for us than we still tried to play in tune, and we still rehearsed and tried to make ourselves technically as good as we could. But the core of the music, where is its power? That became much more important to us. And that's, of course, what we tried to talk about with them, too. Like, why should you care about this music?
So I assume that you then started having to think about that yourselves a lot more than you ever had before.
I think so. Because at Eastman, you don't have to think about that because everybody agrees with you.
Yeah.
Beethoven's great. You don't have to discuss, like, why should we care about mm-hmm. it. So it was incredibly educational for us, and like I said, even thought shaping and career shaping for us. The things that we decided to do, even post Iowa, were very much shaped by where we thought the power of this music lay and where our roles as musicians in this world lay.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with David Ying, the cellist of the Ying Quartet. They're in town in Spokane right now, but we're talking about the town of Jessup, Iowa, and getting your start there. And so then you say it was so successful that you re-enlisted for a second year.
We did. I think that, well, as I mentioned, the town had to make certain commitments for us to be there. They provide us a place to live, and the school district, K-12 school district, had to put a certain amount of resources in. So they had a very forward-thinking school superintendent there who convinced somehow the school board to vote 3-2 when we came to support the string quartet and defer the buying of new lawnmowers.
That's a great story.
And we were not required to mow lawns either while we were there. They wanted us to come and play string quartets for them. I think he had the idea that even though he himself didn't know a lot about what string quartets were, the idea of four really dedicated musicians and passionate about what they were pursuing would be a powerful role model for his students somehow. The first year was quite successful from all points of view, including ours. We loved being there. I mean, I can't imagine having been anywhere else now that I look back at it. But they had to reallocate funds for this second year. So I'm proud to say they again deferred lawnmowers and voted 5-0 in the second year. And the second year was even more noteworthy than the first, I think. National TV came to town to... which was incredibly exciting for the town, and people showed up in droves for concerts. I think maybe 700 or 800 people at a time would show up for a concert in a town of 2,000. That's a lot. So,
well, the famous parallel of the Music Man, just down the road a ways to the west of there, where that happened. But the love and respect that people have that came through in Meredith Wilson's background too, that you experienced, because they were very proud and pleased to have music, weren't they?
Yeah, and I'm excited. We actually are. It's funny to be talking about this right now. We're in May going to go back to Iowa, Northeast Iowa, and we're gonna see a lot of our friends there. It's been 25 years since we first moved there, and about 125 since Dvorak went there.
Oh yeah,
Spillville.
Yeah.
And so we're gonna play a concert in Spillville.
Oh good. Yeah.
We're going
to,
again, we're
going to
dust off the American Quartet that we played so many times during those 2 years there that we thought we'd probably never play it again, but it's a great piece.
Oh,
so
yeah.
we're still playing.
Of course.
So that's exciting to be going back and celebrating it again.
And you've kept in touch with these people. What can you say was your long-lasting mark? Do you have evidence of that?
So, I mean, I think our initial thought was like, oh, well, these people have not gotten to hear much string quartet music, so after we play for them, they'll love string quartet music and listen to it for the rest of their lives. I certainly hope that they got that, and I think they did get that from that. But the bigger takeaway for us was not so much that they're going to love string quartet music or even classical music per se, even though, yes, they know much more about it. I'm sure they listen to it more frequently than they did before. To me, the big takeaway was that the arts can create community amongst people. The arts give a reason for us to find connection with one another. I saw that the other night at the first Bach Festival concert. All these people gather in this room because they love music, but also because they love being together. And it was hard almost to end intermission. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Because people are enjoying the communal aspects that the arts bring to our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. David Ying of the Ying Quartet. We'll take a little break playing a little bit of Arensky, not the same Arensky they're going to be playing, but we'll get a sense of the composer Anton Arensky as played by the Ying Quartet, then come back and talk a little bit more about the present as opposed to the past. This is the theme and variations from the string quartet number 1. the conclusion of Anton Arensky's first quartet is a theme and variations, and that was a performance by the Ying Quartet, which recorded both of his string quartets as well as his piano quintet. I'm with David Ying of the Ying Quartet, so you must kind of be the definitive performers of Arensky's chamber music on the planet.
I haven't heard of anyone else learning all those pieces, but he's a very underappreciated composer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Tchaikovsky, it was known that Tchaikovsky was kind of jealous of Arensky, actually, even. He's a skilled composer. And those theme and variations movements, we're doing another one with Zul Bailey. In the second quartet, the middle movement is the theme and variations. They're beautiful and brilliant.
Yeah, Russian music. I mean, Russian music fascinates me because is it Russian? Is it European? I don't know. What do you think about Russian music?
It's Russian. You're absolutely right. It has such a flavor. There's such a, a gift for melody there. There's an appreciation of their folk traditions embedded in there. And the thing that I respond, going back to what we talked about in Iowa, the thing that I respond to most in music, I realized, and what Iowans and everyone else does, is its inner human qualities. And if it stirs you, then, whether it's Russian or whatever, it's kind of, for me, it's worth playing and listening to.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's spend a minute with your relationship with Zul Bailey, because you're here playing as a string quartet, but on every concert you're also collaborating with him. And so you played Beethoven on Tuesday, and on Friday you're playing Arensky, I think, and then on Sunday you're playing Brahms.
That's right. And we're also doing a version of the Schumann Cello Concerto
on
Friday that we created ourselves together, the five of us.
Yeah. So talk about how did this happen?
So Zul and we were put together in a series, I believe, in Indianapolis to play the Schubert Cello Quintet, which is the classic and amazing piece that a string quartet will always play with an extra cellist. So we hit it off. I enjoy other cellists anyway. Cellists like hanging out together.
They do, you guys are about to take over the world, I'm convinced.
I don't know about that, but we have fun. And so we started chatting after the concert, what are the other things that string quartets could do with cellos? And so we started talking about some of the other pieces that exist that are not as well known as the Schubert, but also we just started talking about what things don't exist that we could do. And the Beethoven Kreutzer arrangement that we did the other night, it does exist, but no one plays it because it's too hard to put together. It's extremely difficult. But we thought, we're stupid enough to try. and then he mentioned that he had been thinking about the Schumann Cello Concerto, because he told me, at which I had known about, that Schumann had this idea that it could be done and would be done, even in his preference, as a chamber version. So it's just that no one had really created a great version of it, we thought, together. So we thought, let's try and do that. So out of that sprung a lot of other things. And Zul's kind of a one of a kind. So enjoy hanging out with him.
Of course. So the Schumann, does Zul play strictly the concerto solo part, or is it?
We first experimented with a version where he would sort of, when he wasn't playing the solo part, it would sort of be him embedded within the other things. And we found that it actually didn't work so well. Mm. And the orchestration is light enough that we thought the quartet could handle it completely. So we did have to adjust some things from what we were working with, and even adjust our playing a little bit at times to sort of capture a little bit more breadth. But at the same time, what the strength of this arrangement is that you hear the intimacy of this concerto. Zul has told me at times that every time he plays this with an orchestra, he feels like he has to play too loud.
Isn't that the cellist's common complaint?
But especially in this piece, because it's kind of the thing about volume and trying to produce volume on a cello or any instrument, it can change the character of the music. Yeah, well, trying to say something loving when you're shouting at the top of your lungs is hard. So, for example, the second movement of the Schumann Concerto is so intimate and so, loving. And in this version, when he's only playing with a quartet as opposed to a full orchestra, I think he has the luxury to do a lot of things that he wouldn't be able to do
Nice. And so that's one of the many things in the collaborations. There's two more concerts. It's we'll talk about the other things in a minute, but there's major concerts Friday night at the Hamilton Studio and then Sunday afternoon back at the Barrister Winery where many of the concerts take place. But you're doing some of these guerrilla things too, aren't you? Aren't you doing a thing at noon? Are you doing
Box lunch.
Box lunch, and that's in the Crest Gallery at River Park Square. And so that's going to feel kind of like Iowa, isn't it?
It will, yeah. In Iowa, I mean, in our town, they didn't even have an auditorium. So even when we finally got around to playing a so-called concert, actually, we did many things besides play concerts in Iowa. Only once in a while we'd play an actual concert. But they always took place in the gymnatorium of the school. It was a big point of success when the crowd started getting big enough they had to pull out the bleachers for the audience to sit on. I love the way that music can intersect with community. And when you're a string quartet, you can play anywhere as long as you got a little place and some people to listen. So it'll be fun to be a part of the Spokane community this week too.
Yeah, and finally, at Eastman, you are uniquely drawing on Iowa and your experiences to do something different than what a quartet in residence might do there. Talk about what you are. What you're teaching, what you're accomplishing in Rochester?
Well, as powerful as our experience in Iowa was, there was one thing that was a little bit discouraging about it to me, and that is we had spent 2 years of our life playing and doing all sorts of things there, and it was one small town in this vast country, never mind the world. And for us to sort of have that experience with other people, that's the way chamber music should be. I'm not suggesting that we should be doing things in large stadiums and amplified and stuff. Mm-hmm. But through Eastman, we had the opportunity to amplify that kind of work because there we're training, you know, every year generations of our future professional musicians. And if they could catch a glimpse of their role as musicians, not just to play beautifully Beethoven quartets and other pieces, but to create community wherever they're planted through their musical gifts. We thought that's an amazing way to sort of multiply our experience there, to sort of help it regenerate in many other places.
So how do you do that?
So we have all the kids, even though they don't quite understand it yet, because you learn the most when you leave Eastman. But even while you're still at Eastman, we have them interact with the Rochester community in small ways, in little glimpses and little bites of what we got to experience in a full-on buffet in Iowa. Not hoping that they'll learn everything that we learned in Iowa, but at least be intrigued. And then when they do leave Eastman, go back and like, oh, okay, that's where this thing that I experienced at Eastman is headed. And I could take that little thing that I learned at Eastman or the experience I had and sort of put it to use now where I am. Mm-hmm. That's been our goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even more specifically, what are some of the lacks within your average really hotshot young string player that you need to teach and that you need to make them aware of to become a full musician?
So most of us musicians are pretty bad at explaining why we like music so much. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, we can demonstrate pretty well with our instruments in our hands or through our voices singing. But talking about music is sometimes difficult. And talking about it in a way that a layperson can understand, even more difficult, because at Eastman we talk about things like submedians and all sorts of random chromatic progressions. And I mean, that doesn't really make a bit of difference, we learned, in a certain sense. It's how music stirs the soul. So how you can talk about that in a personal yet concrete way, you know, to point people to the things in music that are actually noteworthy and that might matter to us, that is a skill. Most kids that come out of Eastman, myself included in the day, we know way too much about music to be able to do that well. Mm-hmm. So being able to distill all that information that you've got running around through your head and point to what are the two things that are going to make the most difference when you hear this piece that we're about to play, that's a surprisingly tall order for musicians. So we try to help students think along those lines. Well, at the same time, they're filling their minds and their hearts with tons of information about music. It's what music schools are made to do, and Eastman does it in a wonderful way.
Sure. David Ying, cellist of the Ying Quartet. Well, we're going to go out with the last movement of this arrangement from Beethoven's time, more or less, of the Kreutzer Sonata, the Presto movement. So I'm going to make you prove it. Tell us what we're about to hear in the Presto movement.
Okay, so Beethoven was someone whose imagination was just on the edge of everybody's consciousness. He wanted to prove to everyone that there was music that they didn't even imagine that they could hear. So that's hard for us to imagine now in today's day because we've heard a lot of stuff since Beethoven. But I want to say that Beethoven, because he proved that music could go places where it hadn't gone before, paved the way for so many composers after him. To this present day. I think he's probably the biggest reason why people still write string quartets today is because he wrote music that pushed string instruments to their edge. So in this piece, you'll hear speed. You'll hear energy that I don't think people had heard come out of a string quartet before. Now, granted, this piece was not originally a string quartet, but it was a violin sonata, so he was thinking along the lines of string music, and certainly the actual string quartets he wrote press us that way. So you're going to hear some pretty amazing energy. I'm glad this is recorded this morning. I'm not sure I could get through it before noon.
Here it is with the Ying Quartet and Zuhal Bailey. Thanks so much for coming in.
Sure, very pleasure.
Here it is.
Thank you.
The conclusion of the arrangement. Beethoven wrote a sonata for violin and piano, a well-known one called the Kreutzer Sonata. And then right after Beethoven's death, the phrase is contemporaneous with Beethoven, somebody created it for string quartet and extra cello. So two violins, one viola, and two cellos in that arrangement, which was recorded by the Ying Quartet and Zuhal Bailey, and was also played Tuesday night at the opening concert of the Bach Festival.